At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Hello, lovely listeners of the Hadean Podcast. Happy Leo season to you all. In this month's episode, Erzsé Barthold joins me once again and takes the reins as interviewer and host to lead a discussion about my forthcoming book, The Hours, The Katarkai of Hygromantia. In this episode, Erzsé asks me to go into details about the nature of magical time, the Greek magical papyri, as well as the mysteries of the North and its stars. We also talk about the evolution of demonic hierarchies and everything else that we love so much about the grimoire tradition. I am very happy to share my research and findings with you all and hope that you enjoy this episode of the Hadean Press Podcast.
Hello, Matt. This is a strange role reversal, but welcome to the Hadean Press Podcast, usually hosted by your fine self and today hosted by Erzsébet. We're going to open with the usual question. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you discovered magic?
Well, first off, thanks so much for having me on, Erzsé. I'm really excited to be on the other side of all of this. But how did I discover magic and how did I come to be so involved with it? I guess I really started my exploration of magic when I was in my mid-teens, I suppose, with the advent of the internet and my interest in just finding strange things. I ended up just being naturally drawn to a lot of esoteric materials I found online. And I found a lot of Thelemic stuff and Golden Dawn stuff, but I didn't really understand a lot of it. And of course, I ended up gravitating towards chaos magic, which was really popular back then, especially through like chaosmagic.org and occult forums back in the day. And I read a lot of Philip K. Dick, and I got into Robert Anton Wilson, and I read Grant. It wasn't long until I started finding pagan moots around my area in Derbyshire, and later in, around Greater Manchester. And eventually, I discovered New Aeon Books in Manchester City Centre, and I started hanging around with the owner and all the people that would hang out there. And ultimately I ended up meeting a lot of really cool, really interesting characters and, you know, making some friends. And, I ended up taking a lot of classes, usually in pubs, with people like David Rieti and Jack D. Hawkins, and hanging out with people afterwards, doing magic in the city at night afterwards, and then the next day we'd like go out and we'd hunting for materia in the parks, and we'd go into the countryside and stuff. I had a lot of fun back then, and it all just became so deeply interesting to me. I was just drawn to it from the start, and I've never looked back. After that period, I finished college and I went off to university. And then while I was there, I decided that chaos magic wasn't really worth doing unless you actually developed, skills in an actual, tradition or an actual practice. So I decided to master ceremonial magic, which was honestly a mistake, I think. I had no idea just how deep that rabbit hole would actually be. I read through and I practiced Dunning and Phillips planetary magic, and I worked through Craig's modern magic and Techniques of High Magic by Skinner and Francis King. A friend had given that to me in a few years earlier, but I just never actually worked it properly. Yeah, I worked through those curriculums as best as I could over 3 years. I met a couple of like-minded people at university, and, you know, we studied together, which was fun. The whole time since I was young, though, I'd just been interested in the grimoires. It's just you couldn't find much information about them outside of, like I said, like New Falcon publications and things. And, you know, they were pretty good in their day in the 90s and the early 2000s. But, you know, they don't actually have a lot of, you know, you couldn't compare those texts to, like, say, what Joseph H. Peterson is producing today, like day and night. But yeah, the whole time I just didn't think that the grimoires had much to do with magic. I mean, they were there, but I didn't understand their place in the whole system, if you know what I mean. I didn't understand how important they were. And, you know, they didn't appear to be so important to Western magic at the time, you know, as much as I might laugh at that idea now. But yeah, after university, I moved to Japan and I got immediately involved in Zen Buddhism. That was due to my interest in playing Go. My teacher at the time, Shiga Sensei, who must have been in his mid to late 80s at the time, he told me that he would teach me if I joined him at the temple on Sunday morning. So I mean, I agreed, and of course I ended up developing this really strong meditation practice with him that's been, you know, a massive part of my life ever since. And I suppose after that, it was my wife's family that introduced me to Shingon, which is essentially Japanese esoteric Buddhism, which is our family's religion. Now I'm married, I have access to experiencing specific parts of Japanese culture, which, you know, I think most people never really get to experience. And yeah, I'm just infinitely grateful for that. I really feel like I belong here. Like, magic is still just alive, almost mundane in some ways, you know, it's everywhere. And I think throughout this whole process, it was really the grimoires, which had always really interested me the most out of everything. But it was always that there was the least amount of material published on them that I could really find anything about. Then I think it was back in 2010 or 2011 or so, when I first discovered Jake Stratton Kent's writings. And I think it was Geosophia was the first text that I got. And yeah, after reading that and his True Grimoire, I realized that finally I'd found what I'd been looking for all this time. And yeah, I realized that there's just so much more to grimoire practice and so much more depth to it that I was just blown away, really. And yeah, from that point on, I was just hooked. I went all in, and I realized it wasn't just some fringe thing, you know, like, or that it was like all how Crowley had described it as like being psychological. There was just so much more left to discover, which I think was the most fascinating thing for me. So I just jumped in, and I've pretty much been reading everything that I can get my hands on the subject ever since, and just, you know, developing my practice as much as possible. And yeah, now I'm primarily working with the Grimoire Verum, but I'm equally as entrenched in working with the Four Kings and everything that comes along with working with them, as well as being just, you know, as passionate with my work with the Greek magical papyri. But yeah, I think that pretty much brings us up to the modern day.
It does. It does. Can we then say that Jake was your gateway drug into grimoire practice?
Well, I think I was already really interested in the grimoires. He just gave me permission to go full on into it, because up to that point, I just thought that they were these strange documents, or there wasn't that many of them, maybe. But I realized after I got into Jake that, oh no, this is an this isn't just a genre. The grimoires are essentially the backbone of the entire tradition, you know. There's so much depth to it, so much more depth to it than I had previously imagined. So I used to think that I knew almost everything I could about you know, most of Western magic, and then I read Jake and realized that actually I know nothing. So So since then, it's really just been just me deepening my passion for the grimoires and learning as much as I can, developing as much as I can in that direction.
So we're here today to discuss your upcoming book, which may or may not have something to do with grimoires. Your book is The Hours, The Katarkai of Hygromantia. And for those in our audience who aren't familiar with this text, could you give us a brief description of the Hygromantia and tell us what is the meaning of Katarkai?
So I'll start with Katarkai because I think that's a little simpler to explain. Katarkai is, it just means inauguration. An inauguration of an activity, usually like the best time to start something. And this is what we would label today as hemorology, which is like the study and practice of making the best use of a specific unit of time. So a season, a day or an hour. And yeah, I think outside of the grimoire specifically, I've been quite influenced by this idea of hemorology, specifically because of the use of them in Japan where I live. So we have this concept called Rokkyu, which literally translates to 6 days. And we have these 6 different types of day that take place during the year. I remember being kind of surprised at some points where like we would have some activity prepared at work, but my staff members would say, oh, actually, no, we can't do it on this day because it's a bad day. It's an inauspicious day. Or they would be planning specific events for good days. So it's very much alive and well in the East. And I'm pretty confident that the idea of Rokkyu comes from China. So I imagine that they practice the same thing over there as well. And most of the Asian, or most of the Eastern world probably practices something very similar. But this idea, I think, has almost been entirely lost in the West. We don't really have auspicious days that we make use of anymore, really. So Katarkai are units of time in which we can do magic. And this connects to the Hygromantia, because the Hygromantia has these massive lists of units of time in which you can do specific things, or which certain things are favorable or auspicious or unauspicious in many cases. But what is the Hygromantia? The Hygromantia is this document from the Eastern Roman Empire, Byzantium. It's the documents that we have that exist today are dated to around the 14th century, but there is some evidence that the core of the text, at least, could go back at least as far as the 6th century. So there's this really interesting overlap at some point with the ancient world of the PGM, which I think goes up to about the 5th century, 4th, 5th century of the Common Era. And then you have like the Coptic manuscripts, Coptic texts, Coptic magical papyri, and they sort of go over both a little. There's a bit of overlap there. And then we have this text called the Hygromantia. It literally means water bowl divination. But I think Skinner and David Rankin, they sort of finessed the definition of it a little more, and they suggest that it's specifically about constraining demons in urns of water. So it does have both of those meanings. But yes, the primary core of the document is about talisman making as opposed to divination. There is some divination in there, so the title is a little misleading in some ways if you follow it as an actual water bowl divination, but yeah, it makes a lot more sense if it's about conjuring demons, because the book is full of that. So my main source text is the translation of Hygromantia put together by Ioannis Marathakis. He wrote this document for Golden Horde Publishing, which I hope our listeners are really familiar with. And if they're not, then I really highly recommend that you check it out, because it's one of the best collection of source documents translated that we have available. I think it was Golden Horde was put together by Stephen Skinner and David Rankin as a vehicle to, you know, publish as many of the foundational texts in the Western Grimoire tradition. So yeah, seriously, check it out if you don't know. And yeah, thank you so much to Stephen Skinner and David Rankin for all of your hard work and effort over the years, because yeah, it's amazing stuff. Thank you for just pointing out such amazing, wonderful material for Grimoire nerds, for like me to chew on. So yeah, much appreciated. And yeah, I guess you could say that the Hygromantia is the prototype of many of the grimoires that we get in later Europe, specifically the genre that we call the Key of Solomon. It has almost all of the same contents, many of which like are like later streamlined or even like watered down. But what we find is that after its transmission into Italy, which is probably just before and around the fall of Constantinople in the mid 15th century at the hands of the Ottomans, that we see like a noticeable like evolution in the European grimoires. And it's this this explosion in the development of the Solomonic genre that I'm particularly interested in. And yeah, we see many of the concepts that we find in Hygromantia are like repeated again throughout these subsequent texts, while of course like they're blending with the previously established Western European trends. So yeah, I think it's a really interesting document because it preserves many of these ideas, many of which, you know, they come from Greek and Arabic sources, and they offer us this window into a much earlier level of development, but you know, also, you know, this more refined astrology and astrological concepts. So yeah, it's definitely a text that needs to be viewed more and appreciated more. And yeah, for me, writing this text really is sort of like a love letter to the Hygromantia, because I do think it's really important that we analyze it more and we study it, and you know, even selectively adapt components of it and bring it into our tradition and bring it back into our practice. I think all the technology, all the techniques are there, they're just waiting for us to develop them. So yeah, I think it's a really interesting, really fascinating document, because it preserves many of the concepts which were lost during that process of transmission.
So your interest in the 6 days, the inauspicious and auspicious days that you encountered when you moved to Japan, is that really what piqued your interest in the timings, the hours and timings of the Hygromantia? Is that where that came from? Or did you have some of that beforehand? Did you see it in any texts before you moved to Japan? Because I know in the Cyprian literature, like in the old almanacs, there's always lists of this is a bad day to plant your whatever. This is a bad day to reap this harvest. Is it your experience in Japan that really piqued your interest in that part of the Hygromantia?
Yeah, essentially, because I thought, wow, Japan is living this tradition. And I don't see, as in everybody does it. It's natural for everybody to do it. So when I encountered it in this grimoire, I thought, oh, maybe this is the point in the grimoires where we can see this in the Western tradition, in the European tradition. I say European and Western, but we need to air quotes both of those, because we're really talking about this.
Yeah, we do indeed, yes.
We're really talking about everything from Egypt, the Near East, even as far as maybe India, all of this, these concepts, philosophies, you know, being translated and retranslated and copied and recopied, and this big soup. But yes, it was that idea that in Japan we have these inauspicious and auspicious days, and I thought, wow, this could be really interesting to highlight and, you know, make a point in the grimoire tradition and then sort of explain that to everybody in my book.
Is there any, apart from the hours and timing, when you take the hygromancia as a whole, is there anything else embedded in that book, in that text, that you feel needs to be or could be brought into the contemporary grimoire revival?
So the text itself is so full of everything that you find in the grimoire revival, everything that you find in the grimoires. But there are some specific components of it that I think are developing well now that weren't developing at all 5 or 10 years ago. And I think maybe one of the largest parts of that is outside of time and timing is probably cardinality. The idea of the four principal directions, even tying those to specific spirits like the four kings and the zodiac, connecting it all with astrology. There's that aspect of it as well. There's also this idea, I think, that really needs to be highlighted, in my opinion, is that the talismans, the designs that we find in the later Keys of Solomon, they seem to have calcified. They've become hard and rigid, and you have to copy them perfectly. There's this idea that we have to copy everything in the past exactly as it was, or it won't work. You know, if you get one little squiggle wrong, then maybe the whole thing won't work. And I think in the Hygromantia, the authors of that offer very little images, very very few images of the specific planetary or like specifically timed talismans, but instead you get like an idea of things that you can include. So I like this idea of bringing talismans back to the creativity of the individual, and I think that the Hygromantia really offers that to people.
Now, you've said that much of the importance of astrological timing had been lost to the West, in quotes, by the end of the 17th century. How does or does your book, The Hours, address this?
So I need to qualify this a little bit and explain it, because I'm not saying that all of the mechanics of magical timing have been lost or the mechanics of magical timing have been forgotten. I think anyone with a suitable knowledge of astrological concepts will see why these things are important. But the ideas that you see presented in, say, the more modern grimoires post-17th century, specifically like the French blue grimoires, like the timings you see in the observations of creating ritual tools like the wands, for instance. So what I'm getting at is that you do see a lot of astrological concepts within these texts, but they've been presented without rationale, right? And we have to remember, like, the grimoires were notebooks. They weren't training manuals. And the people who were copying them may have had a solid understanding of the astrological concepts for, like, you know, making the tools or, like, casting specific spells. But I think that this rationale is mostly lacking from practitioners today. Although, you know, like I said earlier, I do think that this is changing. But, people are more astrologically fluent today. But like the damage has still been done, I think, and, you know, in a lot of magical circles. And I think that the grimoire revival itself needs to focus far more on reclaiming astrology back into it as a practice. Then we have this problem which creeps in, you know, where astrological conditions are copied over and over and over again. And the people who are copying the details over the centuries, they know less and less about the reasoning why, until, you know, we see errors start to slip in, and then the errors start to get copied. And because, you know, nobody understands, or, you know, the rationale behind these concepts have been forgotten. Nobody remembers, nobody understands maybe the rationale and the reasonings anymore. And so what I'm trying to explain here in my book is that the exact reasonings for specific timings, you know, and why these are important and how you can develop them and develop this understanding yourself. So, like, you know why certain hours are better than others, and, you know, how you, the sorcerer, can utilize this knowledge to better understand a lot of the magic that you will find when you start reading through the grimoires. So it makes sense, you know. I want to explain why these concepts are important. So, for instance, you know, in the Grimoire Inverum, we have to harvest the wood for our wands under very specific conditions, right? So, for instance, you know, it has to be under a waxing crescent moon on a Tuesday, for instance, you know. And we, you know, similar for like the pens have to be made under a waxing crescent moon on a Wednesday, etc. So why are the days important? Why are those hours important? And in combination, why are they important? You know? So like the text itself doesn't give any explanation. You just have to do it at those times. You know, why? You don't understand why, you have to do it. So what I'm trying to do is explain why it's necessary to understand and why it's important to know that those specific times are important in our magic, right? And I think that what's happened is because many people don't know why these things are important, that they think to themselves, you know, ah, well, you know, maybe I can just wing it and, you know, it doesn't matter. Or today's a full moon. Full moons are good, right? You know, and they don't consider anything else around it as to why those things might be important. So yeah, then, you know, they do their work on some arbitrary day maybe and don't even consider the reasonings. Because, you know, generally speaking, astrology has been lost, you know, over the past few decades, you know, since the 90s, really. It was made very, very unpopular by, you know, chaos magic. But yeah, it was Peter Carroll who very specifically was opposed to astrology in magic. And I think he did a great deal of damage in the like the late 80s, the early 90s. He was pretty negative about astrology throughout all of his books, but I think it was specifically in his book Cyber Magic, where he wrote, I actually have a quote here from him. He says, some star signs are more inclined to believe in astrology more than others, in particular those either born or nurtured with their intellects in feces make the best candidates, end quote. So, you know, I always thought it was some kind of, you know, like meta joke. You know, it was pretty ironic to say like nothing is true, everything is permitted except astrology because I hate it, you know. What I'm trying to do, I'm really trying to bring people to understand why those specific things are important, why that astrology, those astrological concepts and planetary virtues and things like this that are important, as opposed to just, you know, following something by rote as it's written in a grimoire, you know. And then by understanding why they're important and how to use them, you can go out, you know, and you can use them by yourself, you know, create your own or perform your own rituals, doing your own things, you know, to you know, finding your own specific astrological conditions that make sense and then utilizing them, you know. I'd like to get rid of the idea of rote repetition and copying for the sake of copying, while also, you know, giving people the tools to create their own talismans, perform their own conjurations, and work their own magic, you know, using a systematic process that we can, you know, we all agree on it, because astrology, I mean, yeah, there's some differences in the way that we interpret astrology depending on the origin of the astrology, but, you know, we can quibble about the details later. What we can do is we can bring astrology back into our regular magical practice. And, you know, I think the foundations for it are there. It would be so simple for us to pick this back up. So, and, you know, bringing it back specifically to the Grimoire revival, I think really needs this.
That brings me on to my next question. In your book, you do spend quite a bit of time describing the importance of the stars. How significant do you feel the magic of stars and constellations like Draco and Ursa Major is? Is that something else we need to reclaim? Is that another rabbit hole we need to go down?
100% yes. But doing it, though, is very difficult because we don't know. really, a lot of this Star lore, which would have been common knowledge to most people 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years ago. And so we find these motifs that repeat throughout magical and even religious literature. So you find this idea of the number seven being so important in almost all of European Near Eastern magical traditions and practices. Is it because the Greek language had seven vowels, or is it because Ursa Major has seven stars? Ursa Minor also has seven stars, and so on and so forth. So we have all these, there are some competing concepts and ideas as to why these numbers are important, but then we also have the astrology of these ancient cultures. And we can understand that, say, the Egyptians didn't have such a refined understanding of astrology as maybe some occult groups might like to assume. But you know, the Greeks definitely had a mathematical concept of astrology, which was way more defined than anything that had come before it. And then through Ptolemy, etc., we see this further refinement and development up until it's retranslated in the 9th century in Baghdad. And then those documents are then retranslated again in Italy. And those concepts are transmitted from the ancient world through the Arab world into the European world. The idea of the stars themselves, though, I mean, you go back as far as Göbekli Tepe, and you see that the stars were important for some reason. We can't say why. You can make educated guesses as to why, but we don't know. But yeah, the north is specifically important in the work that I'm attempting to iron out in my book. So that's why I focused on Draco, the snake, and Ursa Major and Ursa Minor. Those constellations are found in spells in the PGM. And then later on, we see them being repeated in the grimoire tradition. So there is some connection there. And we see some specific characters, some specific spirits that show up repeatedly around this region of the night sky. So we see, for instance, in the Testament of Solomon, we see Asmodeus or Asmodai, who is connected very much with the north and with this northern constellation, the North Star even. And we also see in the PGM, which was roughly being written around the same time, the first century, second century, this idea of cosmogonic gods being located in the north. So we have Typhon, and we have Mithras also being located there in specific spells. So there was definitely something that was important going on there. And I'm not drawing any major conclusions in my work. I'm just saying that these patterns have emerged and exist, and we should look at them and we should really explore them. As for other stars and other constellations, yeah, I'm still working on all of that myself. So I couldn't give you anything really detailed on other constellations, but the idea of the stars being important, and especially like I mentioned previously with the crossroads, the four kings being connected to the signs of the zodiac, that's important. That needs to be reclaimed. We can work through and understand why those attributions are being connected with specific spirits. And yeah, we need to develop that further. There's this idea that the north is also connected to Tartarus, and that also brings in this like eschatological concept as well. So this idea of the afterlife, and you know, however that's interpreted through different cultures through time, you know, that's up to you as the individual sorcerer working this magic, how you choose to interpret that and work with that. But it still has value and meaning to all of us, and I think that's something that needs to be explored in much more depth. Yeah.
So you're essentially describing or exploring the relationship between the stars, the spirits attuned to those stars, and their impact on which are the good and bad hours or days.
In a way, yes. But I do need to specifically highlight one thing, that while we might be looking at the stars and connecting the stars to these spirits, we need to be conscious that from the perspective of the individuals who are working this magic, and very specifically from, the very like early medieval Christian perspective, is that these, or even an even earlier Greek perspective, I really should say, that these spirits inhabit the air between the moon and the earth. So they're not the stars themselves, but the stars are connected through them through through virtue and coherence, that they are sympathetically linked. So the rays of the stars and the mutability of the air are connected. So the specific inhabitants, or the spirits, the demons, what are angels even in many cases, specifically they're altered by what's happening in the night sky. But they are here and very present in our sphere of operation. So I'm not saying that the stars themselves are where the spirits are inhabited, or where the spirits inhabit. But the air itself, the sublunar realm itself, is the region in which these spirits are active. If that answers the question.
It does. It's a very good distinction to make as well. I think that will, just thinking of the spirits that way really can impact our practice. But I want to ask you about some different spirits now. I want to, let's talk about the infernal hierarchies. So do you feel the development of the infernal hierarchies in particular in the grimoires marks a devolution, evolution, or just a general lateral change of direction from the earlier stellar influence spiritual hierarchies?
Okay, so again, the idea of earlier stellar influence spirits, like I mentioned before, like we're talking about operating within the sublunar sphere, and the infernal is part of that sphere. It's an aspect of it. I think in a more Protestant conceptualization of hell, as opposed to a Catholic interpretation. So the Catholic interpretation would be more like the medieval sublunar spirits are inhabiting the air, and the more modern idea is that like there's an actual physical hell, and that the demons live in hell. How do you feel the development of the infernal hierarchies in the grimoires marks a devolution? I don't think it's a devolution at all. I don't think that the transmission is corrupting, because what I think is culture is evolving. And so I would much rather say that there's always a revolution in hell, and everything is always in this state of upheaval. So I think our responsibility as magicians, then, as sorcerers, is not to take a book that's 700 years old or 400 years old or whatever and then repeat it by rote no matter what, because by today that hierarchy has evolved and changed. So it's our responsibility to sort of engage with the spirits and map that territory and explore it. It's not set in stone, it's not concrete, it's constantly being shifted and changed. I think the spiritual hierarchies themselves, though, there's so much that we could talk about. I think very specifically with the Hygromantia, what really interests me is that it has a hierarchy of four infernal emperors, and we have Lucifer, Beelzebub, Astaroth, and Asmodai, who rules in the north, who I previously mentioned was in the Testament of Solomon, who rules in rules over the North Star. And that northern section, later on, Asmodai's rank there gets lost. But in the Grimorium Verum, which is several hundred years later, we still find Lucifer, Beelzebub, and Astaroth, as opposed to many of the other grimoires which supplement or change out Astaroth for Satan. And so we see this preservation of this specific hierarchy going from the 15th century, or 15th century Hygromantia through to the 18th century Grimorium Verum. So like a good 400 years of transmission there. And I think that's really fascinating, that section, that one component of the hierarchy has survived. However, what has changed, though, is that the four kings are introduced at some point, probably in northern Italy, and it probably thanks to the work of Checco Dioscoli, who I'm writing about at the moment. I think that there's a significant argument that we could make that this idea of the kings being introduced then sort of displaced the emperors, and then the emperors go and get are like applied to a higher component of the, or a new component of the, or a new strata of the grimoire hierarchy, and the kings sort of take over what the emperors used to do, and they're applied to the crossroads and the four the four cardinal signs. So there's this really interesting evolution that is occurring, and I think it's so fascinating to explore it and put the jigsaw pieces together and see how this has evolved. And yeah, you find then in the Grimorium Verum that, say, the four emperors, now the three emperors, they rule over specific regions of the world. And so you find Lucifer, who rules the east, Beelzebub, who rules Africa, and Astaroth, who rules over the Americas. And that's really telling the age of the grimoire itself, because the Americas had been discovered and enough for Astaroth to rule over them. So, yeah, they still maintain something of their previous cardinal aspect, but Asmodai is lost. For some reason, we still don't understand how or why, when that occurs, but it happens. And yeah, I think it's just absolutely fascinating how these traditions cross-pollinate and produce these new revolutions. And yeah, like I said before, it's our responsibility now as individuals practicing this magic to explore this territory and understand, or the lay of the land as it exists today.
So it's clear to me that the Greek magical papyri are central to your work and this work that we're discussing. And you do mention the importance of using laymen and phylacteries. I want you to go into that a little bit more, because I know phylacteries appear in the PGM and laymen's appear everywhere. So how do they relate to the observance of the good days, bad days, good hours, bad hours? You know, what use is a phylactery? Or is it more about when you make it?
So a phylactery could be made at specific auspicious times. Yeah. If you understand the mechanisms of how to apply timing properly, then yeah, I mean, and in the case of the Lemurn detailed in Hygromantia itself, you know, known as the Urania, I mean, it's essentially impossible for us to make that today. You need the skin of an unborn calf to produce the actual material for the Lemurn itself. And, you know, I would much rather argue that you should simply just continue using whatever specific Lemurn is that you are working with and you're most comfortable with in your current grimoiric practice. So, you know, if you're working with the Grimorium Verum, you know, you should be using the first character. If you're working with Ars Goetia, then, you know, use the Seal of Solomon or the Pentagram of Solomon, whichever one it is. How it's actually produced, though, yeah, I mean, you could create your own. You could create your own phylactery. You know, it's just that, you know, that is, if you understand the principles behind auspicious and inauspicious timings, yeah, as well as how to manipulate materia to achieve those things. But, you know, I would argue, I would definitely still say, please use the one that has been established and used for centuries, you know, or millennia, instead of just making one up by yourself. You know, specifically with this one point, I do think that it's a very good idea, you know, to work with something that has been well attested. And yeah, in this case, you know, lean on tradition. If it isn't broken, right, don't fix it. So you could attempt to create your own, but, you know, like the one described in Hygromantia, for instance. But, you know, it's the ones that we're presented with are incomplete, missing sections, you know, or, you know, the actual physical material itself is just so difficult, if not impossible, to get your hands on, you know. There are more modern grimoires that have perfectly useful lamens that you can utilize, and I recommend that you do that.
That seems to be the case with a lot of the older material, isn't it? So let's go back to the, you explore in your book the idea of enmity and bad hours and days. So how important is it then for us to avoid these bad timings?
So bad timings are often a permutation of either of the malefic planets, which are Mars being the lesser malefic and Saturn being the greater. So when you find, for instance, a square with or a bad aspect with Saturn or with Mars in a astrological chart, then there's something negative going on there in some regard, right? The same with the hours. So the hours don't necessarily depend on using aspects in a chart. They're more of a guideline of what planetary permutations of the virtues are in ascent or descent at that time. So, for instance, on a Saturday, there's a conjunction, or sorry, if you're on Saturday in the hour of Mars, then that's probably going to be a bad time to, say, I don't know, start a business, right? There's going to be a those two components, or, you know, or get married, for instance, you know, those are going to be that, those are, that's a bad permutation of things to begin something in. And that's what it is. It's all about this idea of beginnings or inaugurations, right? So what you want to do is you want to make sure that when you start something new, like a business or a pact, for instance, with a spirit in some cases, or, you know, whatever it is that you intend to do, for instance, you know, write a book, for instance, or you know, any other thing that we find in our mundane lives. The best thing to do when utilizing hemerology is to time the beginning of these things for a favorable hour. And if you aren't familiar, you don't understand when the hours are good and bad, you could inevitably find that you've done some magical ritual, or you've done some, you know, you've even just done a mundane action, only to find out that you did it in this bad time, and that's why it didn't work out. So I think a lot of times maybe people do their ritual, they try to do their conjuration, or they try to gain X, Y, and Z, or they try to produce a talisman without taking heed of what, you know, what hours are correct and what, you know, what's a good, well, what the permutations of the hours are in the moment. And then they find out that their object that they've created doesn't work, or the ritual that they perform doesn't work, and they might not understand why. So having this understanding of when the best time to start something, when the best hour for something is to begin or to start the creation of a talisman, it's then that you'll start to find that, oh, okay, it's working. You know, think, you know, your success rate's going to go up. Now, if you add to that that you actually know the names of the spirits that reside in those hours, Okay, that now you're really getting into you're really going to see your magical results sort of explode. They're going to get really good very quickly after that.
Now, I know in the book, in your book, you have very helpfully given us a number of tables.
One or two.
One or two tables that break down which are the good hours, which are the bad hours, etc. And I also noticed that you do comparative tables, like X text says Saturday's a great day. What happens when X text says Saturday's a fabulous day, but Y text says Saturday's a terrible day? And Z text says, well, Saturday's an ambivalent day, do what you want. What is the poor magician to do then?
I think the best thing to do is to really use your best judgment. So, like you said, on a Saturday, Saturday's a really interesting day in the lists that I highlight in the Hygromantia. So, generally speaking, Saturn is the greater malefic. So, it's when it's in its permutations with other planets, it's usually in a binding way or a negative way. But what you find in the Hygromantia is that there's specifically on Saturdays, there are a lot of very specifically like sorcerous applications that you can use. Hygromantia being one of them, and necromantia, yeah, conjuring spirits or talking to demons. Like the offices of these hours and of the spirits that rule over them are very much linked to sorcery. So yes, Saturn could be bad in certain situations. But it's also good in certain situations. And the people who are writing these textbooks, the grimoires, they would maybe have been using one interpretation or the other. So maybe they would be saying Saturday's a bad day because of X. Don't do, don't plant seeds when Mars is, during the hour of Mars, for instance. Like that's not a good time, say, to plant a crop, right? If you understand the principles of astrology that informed these previous authors, and you understand why they've said don't do anything on this day, but on different text says, oh, actually, it's okay because you can do X, Y, and Z. I would say use your best judgment, and B, call the spirits that work in that hour and find out what they can do. Because even in certain situations where otherwise a permutation of planetary forces would be really, really terrible, there's still a spirit that resides there that you can conjure, you can communicate with, you can learn from. And maybe it would be a terrible time to start a business, but it might be a really good time to curse an enemy, right? So and the offices themselves are quite vague in some respects, and a lot of the sections are missing and whatnot. But you can use your best judgment to work out. And if you to work out what to do best, and if you understand the mechanics behind it, then you can apply your own judgment. And yeah, be careful, of course. But as long as, like we mentioned previously, if you have a phylactery, if you have a lumen ready and present, then yeah, always have that ready and present when you're working with potentially dangerous spirits. But yeah, experiment, get your fingers burned, work stuff out by yourself, and yeah. Make your own judgment, I really think, is the best.
Do you have any other advice or recommended books for people who are, A, either just getting started with any kind of grimoire practice or a grimoire practice more specific to the materials found in the PGM, the Hygromantia, and in working with the hours?
So first of all, you really do need to have Marathakis's translation of the Hygromantia from Golden Horde Press. I really couldn't recommend it high enough. It's been really inspirational to me. And yeah, as a foundational document for how to grimoire the grimoires, how to work them, I think it's invaluable, because you see on the fundamental level that necromancy is a component of this work, and timing is a component of this, and cardinality is a component of this. And like I said, a lot of that is lost in a lot of the later grimoires. We don't see it, but we see it all here. So definitely get your hands on the Hygromantia if you can. Maybe this one might sound a bit left field for a lot of the listeners, but I think Amina Inloes, her translation of the Son of Knowledge, which is a an Arabic astrological text, has recently been published. I think it was published last year or the year before. Absolutely foundational if you want to understand, for instance, why a lot of astrological timing is used. It goes into great depth of that, and it also has a lot of really interesting magic about, for instance, like the magic of letters and of timing and creating talismans. So that the Son of Knowledge is a really, really valuable text to have on your bookshelf. Eric Perdue's translation of Agrippa. Agrippa really, if you read Agrippa from beginning to end, like Eric goes on about a lot, and I really recommend you don't just jump in and read the cool sounding chapters. Read it from beginning to end, because what it does is it lays out the full like occult philosophy as it exists in Agrippa's mind. You might, of course, have your own ideas about where Agrippa gets things right and where he gets them wrong, but the foundational component of it, having that under your belt, knowing why the elements are important in producing the virtues that create the planetary permutations, all of those concepts are laid out from beginning to end systematically, so you understand it. By the time you get to the end of the document, you understand why everything is important. So 100% I recommend people read Agrippa. And if people are interested in that further, I think that Dr. Justin Sledge on the Esoterica YouTube channel has just started a long form lesson on Agrippa and his three books of occult philosophy. So if you aren't familiar with that YouTube channel, then please go and check it out. He's only done one lesson so far, but it's guaranteed to be fantastic. So I really recommend people go and check that out. Of course, the Greek Magical Papyri by Betts, get your hands on that. And if you can, Griffin and Thompson's Leyden Papyrus, which Jake Stratton Kent loved and always went on about, and it inspired me to go and get a copy. So I've got a really knackered old copy from the 1970s that's sort of half fallen apart, but it's so worth getting your hands on in paper if you can. And if not, maybe try and conjure it into a PDF somewhere. Of course, everything by Dr. Stephen Skinner and David Rankin and Joseph H. Peterson. And yeah, if you can sit down and really, read academic texts, then yeah, Richard Kiefer. And there's the Routledge History of Medieval Magic, if people are familiar with that. It's a really good foundational text. But yes, I think that's pretty much everything. I mean, there's so many other texts that I could talk about, specifically like the Book of Oberon, which I know is one of your one that you absolutely love. I adore it as well. Please get your hands on that if you can, because that is, despite being one of the later grimoires, it's one of the most complete grimoires. And it's a really workable system. So yeah, 100% get your hands on that. But yeah, I think that's all my recommendations for books I can think of.
Okay, well, we are running out of time, but I just want to ask you one more question. Are you working on anything else at the moment? And what can we expect in the future from you, Matt?
So I've already finished, it was one very big book, and now it's two medium-sized books on the English Kabbalah, and those are, they're ready almost to come and see the light. But my current projects right now that are being written, I'm working on a project with Brian Johnson, and we are doing a translation of Cecco d'Ascoli's commentary on the spheres of Sacro Bosco. And we're very excited to present that, because it's hardly anybody knows about his contribution to to specifically astral necromancy in the grimoires. And I think because it's never been translated into English, it needs to be read. It needs to be read and understood by people so they can understand how the grimoire tradition was influenced by him and evolved. So I'm very excited to bring that to everybody. And yeah, I've got a few other projects that I'm working on that they are still in their infancy, but they're plodding along nicely. But of course, we've got the podcast every month and the videos that we produce through Hadean. So yeah, there's busy, busy, busy. Lots going on, and I'm really excited. I can't express just how excited I am really to get my material out in the world.
Well, I do know the readers are going to be in for a real treat with your book. I've edited it, laid it out. I'm still absorbing it, so it's going to be a real contribution to the field, I think. But of course, it's my job to think that, so I must let our readers decide for themselves. This has been really interesting, Matt. I could honestly listen to you talk for another hour, but you've laid down the law, and now we must end. So, if there's anything else you'd like to say to our listeners, you must say it now.
Yeah, I'm just really happy that I'm in this amazing situation where I can contribute, and I can just offer something of, however small, but I'm just so happy that I can do that, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what the reaction is from everybody. So yeah, thank you everyone who tunes in and listens every month, and yeah, I'm just happy to be here and do what I do.
All right, everyone, thank you. We're signing off now. Until next time. Bye.
Well, I hope that you all enjoyed that as much as I did. I was pretty nervous being on the other side of things, but I had a lot of fun with it, and I really enjoyed my conversation with Urze. The Hours is now available for pre-order from the Hadean Press website, link in the description below. I am really looking forward to people reading it and the conversations and debates it will hopefully spark. I am also considering creating a short course to go alongside the book for those who are interested, but more on that in the future. Things are very busy at Hadean recently. We have so many books and pamphlets coming out every month, it is getting a little hard to follow. But Urze and the team are hard at work, ready to bring even more to you this year. Our next guest will be the tireless David Rankin, who has somehow managed to write another book, this one titled Clavis Intelligentarium, which will be a modern manual for the Grimoire Revival, which we are also very excited to share with you. In the meantime, I hope that you are all enjoying your summer and staying hydrated. Thank you for listening, and we will see you all again in the next one.